The 1994 Celtic Sunstone Symposium presents session number 220, The Temple in Current RLDS Theology and Practice, an illustrated lecture by W.B. Pat Spillman.
I'd like to welcome you to this session and remind you that it is by invitation or by name tag or ticket to all the sessions. After the presentation, if there's time, we will have questions. Wesley B. Pat Spillman of Independence, Missouri, is an executive minister of the Reorganized Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and serves as the manager of real estate operations for the church. In this capacity, he has responsibility for the acquisition, development, and disposition of houses of worship and other church properties throughout North America. He also serves as a bishop, which is an office specializing in financial and stewardship ministries. His education includes an Associate of Arts degree from Graceland College, a BA degree in education, and an MA in history from Central Missouri State University. He also has a PhD degree in curriculum and instruction from the University of Missouri at Kansas City. Mr. Spillman is the author of numerous books, training courses, and articles on church history and administration. He most recently co-edited a book with Dr. Roger Lanis, Let Contention Cease, The Dynamics of Dissent in the Reorganized Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. It's my pleasure to welcome Pat Spillman.
Well, I guess it's traditional for a speaker to say how pleased she or he might be to be here, and so I'll continue that tradition by saying, yes, I am also very pleased to be here and to have had this invitation. Like most RLDS, I'm very pleased to be able to share something which is very special to us, and that is some information about our new temple. I think to cut to the chase and to help the LDS members who might not be familiar with RLDS temple concepts to understand what this is all about, I'm going to tell you right off that it is a whole lot different than what the LDS concept is. I'll elaborate on that a little bit more as we get in here. But whereas the LDS temples are sacred edifices in which special rituals, sacraments, ordinances are performed and cannot be performed anywhere else. An RLDS, or the RLDS temple, actually we have two, the Kirtland temple is used basically much the same. They're houses of worship. They do house other kinds of activities, but they're basically houses of worship. And there is nothing in them that can't be done anywhere else. As a matter of fact, there are several things that can be done other places that can't be done in the temple. For example, baptism. You know, baptism is a very active event, of course, in LDS temples. In the RLDS edifice, they don't do it. And I'll just mention right now that several years ago, I was writing an article for our church magazine on the concept of baptism for the dead. Somebody had written in and asked whether that would be practiced in the new RLDS temple. And so I was doing some research, and I happened to mention it to the first counselor in the first presidency, Howard Sheehy Jr., who is an old friend of mine from childhood, and with whom I was playing racquetball. That, by the way, is another significant difference between our churches. our first counselor plays racquetball. At any rate, I happen to mention I was doing the research on this, and the temple planning was underway at the time. And he said, have you come to a conclusion yet? And I looked at him and I said, well, I'm still working on it. He said, well, if you decide that the temple should have baptism for the dead in it, he said, be sure to let us know right away. We're going to have to make some changes in the plumbing diagrams. Well, they don't have it there. So I'll go ahead and get started with my presentation. There will be ample opportunity for questions. As a matter of fact, I'd just as soon do this a little differently than what most do, since we don't have a responder. Our responder's daughter's child got sick or something, or she had to leave out of town unexpectedly and didn't come. And so we have more time than what I had expected. If you have questions, raise them right in the middle of the dialogue. I mean, in my monologue, rather. Just speak out, and we'll talk about it. What's that? We have baptisms in our local chapels. Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah, the question is, where do we have baptisms? We have baptisms in our local chapels. Sometimes in farm ponds, sometimes in the Missouri River. I've been there to all of them. Do we baptize for the dead anywhere? The answer to that is no, we do not. Baptism for the dead is a doctrine that never really got started in the RLDS Church. They talked about it in the early church, but Joseph Smith III believed that it could only be performed in the temple. And since we didn't have a temple, it was a moot point. And as years went by, since we didn't do it, we forgot about it. And a professor of history who just retired by the name of Alma Blair, who taught at the Church's College in Graceland, wrote an article 20 years ago called something having to do with moderate Mormonism, the RLDS Church Moderate Mormons. I think that was the article. It was an article that was presented, I think, at an early MHA meeting. But at any rate, in this, he made the very interesting statement, if I can quote him more or less correctly. It was something to the effect of, a doctrine ignored is a doctrine forgotten. That's basically the idea.
I had a long talk with Alma Blair in Mount Hoover a few years ago. And he told me then, and I don't want to be unfair to him, because I know I'm not quoting from notes, but he said that there were a few incidences of baptism for the dead practiced in the reorganization. In the early period, particularly, there was someone who was a relative in the Smith family who refused to join the organization unless another now deceased relative in the Smith family could be baptized into the reorganization. And that apparently that had occurred. Mm-hmm. He said there weren't a lot of incidences.
Okay, the comment was that there, according to Alma Blair, there had been some baptisms for the dead in the early reorganization. I'm not aware of that. He's done a lot more research in that area than I have. I will take his word for it. Thank you. Well, why don't we go ahead and launch out, if you wouldn't mind turning down the lights just a little bit. We'll proceed. And not yet. Close. Okay, in his prophetic message to the Church's 1984 World Conference, President Wallace B. Smith outlined the purposes for the long-anticipated Independence Temple. Although at the time it was almost lost amid the furor generated by a later paragraph in the document, which opened the RLDS priesthood to women, later generations may well consider the portion of the message devoted to the temple as far more significant. According to the council, which the Church accepted as of divine origin, the temple shall be dedicated to the pursuit of peace. Its primary ministries were to include these: reconciliation and healing of the spirit, strengthening of faith and preparation for witness, fostering an attitude of wholeness of body, mind, and spirit, providing leadership education for priesthood and member, and finally, providing a place in which the essential meaning of the restoration as healing and redeeming agent is given new life and understanding, inspired by the life and witness of the Redeemer of the world. Now, prior to the late 1960s, members of the RLDS Church generally regarded the temple and independence in much the same sense as the concept of Zion. And that is one of those wonderful goals which inspire people, but like the end of the rainbow, just out of reach of the current generation. Take another slide here. That perception was changed in 1968 when President Smith's father and predecessor, W. Wallace Smith, shown in this slide, brought an inspired message to the conference in which the Lord announced to the church that the time has come for a start to be made toward building my temple in the center place. It shall stand on a portion of the plot of ground set apart for this purpose many years ago by my servant, Joseph Smith, Jr. The shape and character of the building is to conform to the ministries which will be carried out within its walls. These functions I will reveal through my servant, the prophet, and his counselors from time to time as need for more specific direction arises. Okay, well, I think we can take that one down now. In fact, you can turn off the overhead now temporarily. Thank you. Okay, an interesting sidelight to that document was an addendum which the... I was wrong. Put it back up again. I forgot about the addendum. Thank you. There it is. Which the prophet provided as a result of concerns expressed during consideration of the prophet's words. Now, I'm going to have to take a little departure from my prepared comments here to explain that the process, well, I'll read a little bit of it, and then I'll explain a little bit more of the process by which a document becomes canonized in the RLDS Church. Before a document purporting to be inspired, I chose those words carefully, may be canonized in the Doctrine and Covenants, it must first undergo scrutiny by each of the church's presiding quorums, councils, and orders. Earlier portions of the document, and this was called Section 149, had redefined certain aspects of the office of bishop. In the RLDS Church, as Margaret has already indicated, bishops are high priests given special financial and temporal responsibilities. Many members of the Order of Bishops, and this is the smallest by far of the RLDS priesthood orders, and by the way, just in case you're interested, the first two women have been ordained to that office just in the last couple of months. They expressed concern over the wording of the document, and in effect, now this will be interesting to LDS, requested that the prophet clarify his message. Accordingly, the prophet retired in meditation, returned 5 days later with a clarification which satisfied the bishops. Imagine asking your president to go back and essentially get more light and inspiration to share with the church. You know, God didn't tell us enough. Go back and get more. That's what happened. In the meantime, discussion about the proposed temple had raised some interesting questions, at least one of which was put to rest by the final paragraph of the document, which advised, it is also to be noted that the full and complete use of the temple is yet to be revealed, but that there is no provision for secret ordinances now or ever. And this is called Section 149A in our Doctrine and Covenants. There will be provision for instructional opportunities which will, of necessity, be restricted to particular category concerned, viz. High priests, patriarchs, etc., etc. Okay, now we're through with that one. Thank you. Okay, the... Yes?
Was there a specific request as whether there would be secret ordinances or not?
That came out of the discussion. Was the question specifically posed? You mean what it had been posed to the prophet?
When they sent him back to the well.
No, that was not part of it. He heard about the discussions and decided to consider that as well. That was conveyed to him by his counselors. Yeah, they went back. They basically told him that this is the feedback we're getting.
Was this section, the first section,
Well, when he was later asked to explain what that meant, the question is, did this preparation for the temple come as a great surprise, or was this had this gone back some time? There had been quite a bit of talk about it, and there had been some money gathered together. This was, in effect, the official beginning of the fundraising project, but it was not put on the front burner. It was still going to be a back burner kind of a thing for the time being. And as it turned out, it was a 20-year back burner before they finally put it as a major priority. I have to keep holding this little light up with one hand. It doesn't have a little hard to read up here. Okay, these two documents, more than any other, have defined the nature and uses of the new RLDS temple in Independence. And that's supposed to have automatic... okay, are we fairly clear now? All right. Ground was broken for the temple at the church's 1990 World Conference. They'd already been raising money really strenuously for a couple of years before that. The building was completed in 1993 and dedicated in 1994. Now, the building sits on a 15.8-acre site on the northeast corner of River Boulevard and Walnut Streets. This is catty-corner from the RLDS Auditorium and just north of the LDS Visitor Center. I'll have a picture of that later on in a different context. I'm sure you'll enjoy it. It rests on a portion of the property set aside by Joseph Smith Jr. in 1831 as a site for up to 12 temples. Certain RLDS dissidents, as well as a few members of the Church of Christ Tempelhof, whose claims to authority includes possession of the traditional site where the Prophet Joseph stood when he dedicated the temple site, and a rock which they claim is the cornerstone of the ill-fated building, dispute the authenticity of the RLDS site, saying that the RLDS edifice is the wrong temple built in the wrong place by the wrong people. The LDS have politely declined to comment on the matter. The RLDS temple was built at a cost of $35 million, plus an additional $15 million for property acquisition, site work, and added facilities to the auditorium building necessitated by the overall project. We're gratified, especially considering that the church's contributor base is probably fewer than 75,000 family units. The entire project was more than paid for by the time it was completed. The several million dollars left over provided the basis for an endowment fund which will underwrite programming and maintenance on a perpetual basis. The leading design architect was the world-renowned Gio Obata of the firm HOK, Helmuth Obata Kassenbaum of St. Louis. The distinctive spiral design grew out of Obata's, I call them doodles, during design consultation in the early phases of the project. Although Obata never publicly claimed inspiration for his design, the spiral was quickly sacralized by many RLDS leaders and lay members alike. I took this illustration right out of one of our church magazines, the Saints Herald. It's fairly clear about the way people were thinking about the spiral design during that particular process. Obata merely explained that the spiral was a natural mathematical function and had pleasing visual qualities. Nevertheless, church members eager to see the hand of the Lord in its design quickly attached symbolic meaning to the obvious resemblance to a stretched-out nautilus shell, including such concepts as infinity, growth, harmony, and unity. You want to put the other one up now? Many older women saw prophetic significance in the nautilus shell theme as they recalled the chambered nautilus was the symbol for the early 20th century organization for young women called the Temple Builders to which they had belonged. They used to have little nautilus shell pins, and they felt, you know, this was a kind of foreshadowing. This is a drawing, an architectural rendering of what it looks like straight up. I have seen an aerial photo that somebody took from a helicopter absolutely right over the spire. It was marvelous. It looks just like that, only it's in color. So the rendering was very accurate, and That's essentially what it looks like if you're about 1,000 feet above it. Okay, we'll move on then. That was one of the design drawings that was done by the architectural firm. So they were, when they were laying out the site plan and so forth. Okay, because the entrance, this is a very early photo, taken when the trees had just been put in. Because the entrance to the temple is on the east, facing away from the auditorium in the center of the temple lot, some people have claimed that Native Americans influenced the location of the entrance. I don't know if you're aware of the significance of entrances to the east among the Native Americans, but that is, at least among some of the tribes, that's very important that any dwellings, including teepees and whatever, have their entrance to the rising sun. I'm not sure how widespread that is. I know it is fairly widespread in the Middle West. The architect says it was chosen simply because it faced the parking lot. The Mormon temples face east? Is that right? How interesting.
All the new temples, if you go up the Bountiful, the symbolic doors, even though the business entrance is on the other side, the symbolic doors are on the east. It's a Masonic.
Is that right? Yes. Well, I don't think that had anything to do with this one. if it did, then that certainly isn't wide knowledge. Is to the east. Well, that's just where they put the parking lot, and I think it was just simply convenient here. The architect designed the main exit to be on the west side of the building facing away from the parking lot. This has caused a lot of scratching of heads. The design theory was that as services were concluded, people would exit from the sanctuary past a large stained glass window depicting the phrase from the Doctrine and Covenants, "Behold, the field is white, already to harvest. Therefore, whoso desireth to reap, let him thrust in his sickle with his might and reap while the day lasts." I'm sure you've read that once before. That's the stained glass window. Now, if you can see wheat and rice in that, you're really good. The wheat is the vertical element. The rice is the circular element. This picture doesn't do as really great justice to this. The white marks are supposed to be sickle marks as somebody goes through it. And if you look really, really close, you can see little individual grains of wheat and rice lying around on the floor. Up in the upper portion of that. This is a huge window. It's about 40 feet high and about probably about that much wide. So, and during the afternoon, it sheds light into that area. It's very greenish gold, beautiful kind of a light. According to the design philosophy again, worshippers would then leave the building through the large bronze doors and descend a grand staircase onto the World Plaza, a large outline of the world done in brown or white brick, brown and white brick, down below there. So that's the exit of the building through the bronze doors, on which is the church seal, down the staircase onto the plaza. There's a little better picture of it that I took recently. That shows the world map. The whole theory is that after the church service, you could tell somebody that they would meet them in Afghanistan. And presuming they were not geographical illiterates, they would be able to find themselves in one place. There is a bit of a problem with this plan, and that is that when people leave the sanctuary, if they go out the west door as planned, they first have to go up that staircase or take the elevator. Now, you can imagine 2,000 people marching out up that staircase to go right out the door and down another one. That has not turned out to be a real popular exit. And it's only been used a few times, unfortunately. once you're out there, then you got to walk around the building to get back to the parking lot. And if it's raining or snowing, that's a bit of a challenge. Well, we'll just show you another picture or two here. This is one of those cases. In this particular case, people were coming. This was taken during a women's conference last year. And they were coming over from the auditorium to have a particular activity there.
What you're saying is that in the reorganized church, the women are more active,
More active than what?
More active than the men.
In the reorganized church, are the women more active than the men? Some of them are more active than some men. I would hate to put statistics to it. Okay, here's another case. This was taken during the dedication at our World Conference earlier this year, at the conclusion of which they released what they called peace doves. I thought they were homing pigeons, but anyway, a whole lot of them went up and circled around a few times and took off toward wherever. But you can see something of the orientation. This is a view from the top of the auditorium, looking more or less northeast. And you can also see the long, slanting walkway up to the rooftop garden, which is on the right-hand side of the spire as you're looking toward it. If you see the bronze doors and the stairway, just to the right of the bronze doors is that large stained glass window I was telling you about. That gives you some idea of the scale of it. Okay, now if you're not already aware of the difference between the LDS and the RLDS concepts of temple, we might just mention that even though we use the same word temple, it has radically different meaning for us than it does for the LDS. I had a similar feeling when I attended my first Mormon History Association meeting in Canandaigua, New York in 1980. I came away from the experience realizing that much of the religious language we were using sounded the same, but the meanings were obviously different. The RLDS are not a people of the temple in the same sense as the LDS. For the latter, the temple is the focus of a rich and symbolic set of ordinances, most of which derive largely from the church's experience in Nauvoo and later. For the RLDS, on the other hand, the temple is basically a worship, education, and office facility, more on the order of the Kirtland Temple of the 1830s. When discussing the RLDS temple with LDS members, it's helpful to compare the RLDS temple to a large church. I've already given you that part of it. Of course, there is a great deal more to the temple than that, but the main function of the temple itself is worship, not the performance of ordinances as it is for the LDS. On the other hand, like LDS temples, the RLDS building features a number of symbolic elements designed to evoke specific emotions and experiences. Unlike LDS temples, though, the RLDS structure is open most of the time to anyone who wishes to visit. Only when meetings dealing with specific priesthood order business or other special group concerns are underway is the general public asked not to enter the sanctuary, and even then a small glass-walled press and public relations room is available for a limited number of observers. You can even go in during one of those and sit in the press room if you want to. The question was, were the archives and library moved to the temple? And the answer to that is yes. I did not take a picture of that because a library is a library is a library. And, you know, it's who wants to see a picture of a bunch of stacks? So I didn't take a picture. It was very nice, got nice little artwork in it and everything, but it's a library. Does the building have a basement? Well, yes, it has a utility room that goes down underneath there, but not a basement where you store stuff. They have plenty of storage room in other places. You know, I don't know what else you... Oh, I think you were getting toward, you know, where's the font? No, not there. Yeah, no, the archives, there's plenty of room for the archives, at least for the time being. Lest we store up a whole lot more history. Okay, where was I? New page. This is a view of the rooftop garden looking back toward the auditorium. I'll just go ahead and mention the RLDS temple is, in fact, two separate structures which are even engineeringly independent, although they're connected by a reception hall and appear as one. The most prominent element of the entire structure is the spiral-shaped temple itself. The companion building, a long two-story building on the south side of the temple, is an office and education complex. I'm going to go back and point that out again. I think I have a better picture later on. I thought I had these things all properly organized, but I'm not sure now. Ah, here it is. this is the office complex is over on the side. What looks like a long dark bar are reflective windows behind which are offices of the various support groups. Unlike what you'd find in a typical executive office building, the offices of the general officers, we call them general officers as opposed to general authorities, just another significant difference. Their offices all face into toward the temple and overlook a meditation garden, which I'll show you pictures of later on. So they're not actually looking out on the street. And that's probably good because if you look out one direction, you just see downtown Independence. If you look out the other direction, you see the LDS Visitor Center. And I'm not sure that that was what they wanted to keep looking at all the time. They can't avoid it, however, as I'll show you later. Okay, this particular picture, now I don't know if you've seen... let me explain another thing. Most of the major policy decisions in the RLDS Church are conducted by a joint meeting of the First Presidency, the Council of Twelve, and the presiding bishop, Bishop Rick, and the presiding patriarch, who now calls himself presiding evangelist because there are women in the quorum. They all meet together as sort of a board of directors. We call it the Joint Council, and they meet around a big table. And I stepped in there last week and took this picture. I guess it would not be too difficult for you to figure out who sits in the high back chair underneath the stained glass representation of a dove of peace. Now, if you are the individual sitting in that high back chair and you look to your left, that's what you see out the window. In case you haven't been to Independence and you happen to be LDS, that's yours. So what they see right out their window is the LDS Visitor Center. Okay, this is part of what's in that area to the right or to the south of the spire, that office building on the second floor. Here is the outside entrance to the First Presidency's office. I didn't want to go in and take pictures of their own offices. I felt they might... they probably would have let me do it, but I suspect it might have interrupted what their work was, so I didn't. This is the... you can't see that side entrance into the Council of Twelve. This is where my bosses are, the presiding bishopric. This is the outer... you go from these doors into a suite of secretaries and then from there into their own individual offices. Well, that shows up real good, doesn't it? Well, that was a very dim view of a lecture room. We'll just move right on. It does have a lot of classrooms, lecture halls, and so forth in that building, generally down on the first floor, along with the library, the Temple School Center, and the archives. They'll also be putting in a large TV studio in that area. This is the reception area from the second floor, looking down to the main reception area, the entrance. You can just barely see the main entrance sort of in the background there. That's where they would be coming in. Let me see where else we are here. Here's a picture. Yes?
I'm sure it's suddenly of interest to all the LDS, this use of the cross. At what point did the RLDS Church begin, at least my observation over my lifetime in the RLDS Church, much more prominent use of that seal of the lion and the lamb? When did it begin? It seems to switch away from that.
Well, actually, I was going to deal with that a little bit longer. The question is, when did the cross start becoming an important figure? That's quite recent, actually. Our LDS churches have had crosses for quite a while, and not all of them, mainly on churches they bought from other denominations and never took them down. But there was quite a debate over whether they ought to have a cross in the temple. And one of the first members of the presidency, who is now retired, that's another difference, was very adamant about it. He said, there will be a cross, at least one, if not more. And he just was unmovable, and they do have crosses. This particular cross, which is on the outside of the little chapel, the little meditation chapel, is made out of wood that has been brought from all over the world, from our various jurisdictions. They each brought a little plank of wood, which was cut into a little rectangular shape and was laminated into this cross. And so it contains probably, 50 or 60 different kinds of wood, some of them rather exotic, from all over the planet. This is one of the activities that was taking place in there during one of the conferences. I don't know which conference it was, but they seem to be having a good time. And that's another thing. The RLDS temple is a place to have a good time. Really. They try to emphasize the joyous aspects of worship there. I just went down and grabbed a few pictures of these. There is a big utility tunnel that goes all the way from the temple over into the auditorium under the street. It's about an eighth of a mile long, and it was never really designed to have people, but it's so convenient, given the climate in Missouri, to use when it's hot in the summer and cold in the winter and so forth. It's just become a regular pedestrian tunnel. So they got to thinking about it. One of the things they decided to do was to put a children's peace pavilion over in the auditorium. They took one of the unused, took back our old museum that was over on the fourth level of the auditorium, and are converting it at the present time into a children's activity center, which will help them understand in ways that children can relate to the concept of peace. And so they decided to turn the tunnel into an art gallery that was designed for children. And it is really interesting. One of the things they have is a little train, and it goes on down the hall. I think I ended up taking all the pictures there just to show you what it was like. That's caboose. It also has numerous panels, carpeted panels, on which artwork done by children is displayed for periods of weeks or months. And so this just literally goes all the way up and down this hallway. It is absolutely fascinating. It's awfully hard to go from my building, I'm over in the auditorium building, over to the temple without spending a time looking at whatever's been brought up new by the children. It has all kinds of little children's figures, and you know, kids just they go ballistic when they go in there. They really enjoy it. Just another example. Okay, now the 300-foot tall granite and stainless steel portion of the building is almost totally occupied by an 1,800-seat sanctuary. The normal approach to the sanctuary is through a curving worshiper's path, which was carefully designed to prepare the worshiper for a sacred experience as they enter into the temple. Again, this is a concept that LDS people would, I think, relate to. This is, boy, they are having a good time next door. What was it? I don't know about you. I kind of wish I were over there. Okay. That's the entrance. It's a little closer representation of the entrance. And closer yet, is that sharp enough? Let me see if I can get a sharper picture. Yeah, that's a little more focused. What that is an etched glass representation of the sacred grove. And if you go into it, it has everything but the black flies that I've encountered there in New York on the two or three occasions that I've been in the sacred grove. It's very beautiful, and it's worth just standing there and taking a look at it for a few minutes. Once you go into the sanctuary, the first thing that you, into the worshiper's path, the first thing you encounter is a panel done in granite. It's polished granite, sandblasted out. It's called What Once Was Lost, Now Is Found. The artist deliberately designed the kneeling figure androgynously. And the theory was that this is supposed to be a representation of the prodigal son. The way the artist drew it, it's kind of the prodigal offspring or something. But the idea is reconciliation. And when you're standing there, you can see your own reflection in the granite. And that was deliberate. Again, you're supposed to be able to see yourself in that particular piece of art. As you go up the walkway, you pass through the shadow of the cross. You can just barely make out the curved worshiper's path there in the background. It's so dark, dimly lit, that my flash wouldn't illuminate it, and my slide came out terribly. I couldn't use it. Farther up, you pass Ikebana, or flower arrangement, which is changed about every time the flowers need to be changed. And the idea there is the harmony of life and various other symbols of life, eternal and so forth. This is the only water outside of in drinking fountains and restrooms that you'll find in the temple. This is the, it's a pool. Just before you enter into the sanctuary, it says, the wording on the back says, whoever drinks of the water that I shall give will never thirst. And it's interesting, that was kind of a debatable legend, and it stayed for over a year untitled until they decided on what particular scripture they wanted to put up there. But it runs, the water runs over the lip of that granite there in the front and has a nice, pleasant gurgling sound, but no fountain, and it's not a baptismal font. They ask you not to throw coins in it. This is the actual entrance. Well, that's really dim. Showed up better, I thought, in my slide when I looked at it, but that's the entrance into the sanctuary. Now that you're in the sanctuary, we'll just give you a few pictures of what we have there. This is about 1,600 to 1,800 seats, depending on how friendly you are with your people. It's all pew seating, almost all of it. If you look up, this is what you see. The spiral going up about almost 200 feet almost disappears into what appears to be a little hole up there. Actually, that's an access to a shaft in which they have to raise the burned-out light bulb or raise and lower light bulbs for the FAA-required clearance light up there on top of the spire. I've been up on there's a stairway that goes around that spiral. I've been up there. I have a little bit of acrophobia, and when I finally got up to the top, it was everything I could do to turn around and go back down again. It's very steep, and it's a very long way down to the floor. Isn't that an interesting view, though? I never get tired of looking at that. The focal point is a large organ. This is I think I have a number in here that might quote it. I don't know if you are an organ person, but 5,685 pipe organ is built by the Canadian firm in Montreal, or just out of Montreal, called Casavant Frere. The organ is a rather rare example of a tracker organ. A tracker organ, I've been told, is one that direct mechanical linkage between the keys and the pipes, which is unusual in modern organs. There are, in fact, windows back behind that you can actually stand there and watch as the organist is playing. You can watch the tracker action working. And sometimes during organ recitals and so forth, we'll take people back there. It's kind of they have to be really quiet. But it is an interesting thing to see. The organist sits up there right down below the main thing, just like Diane Bish would sit in her church, and in a pretty prominent position. My wife, who's an organist, says that she really doesn't like that. It puts the organist on display too much, but nevertheless, there it is. This is a picture that I took from the back of the sanctuary during an activity. You get kind of an idea of what it looks like with people actually involved in things. The meditation chapel, which I mentioned earlier, is a very popular feature. It seats around 75. It's used for in-house worship services and is open to anyone who wishes to use it for meditation. They used to take tours through it. They've decided not to do that now. So you can go in there and stand, be quiet, but they don't talk much in there. On its walls are paintings depicting the eight sacraments of the RLDS Church, each in a different cultural setting. In this particular picture, you'll see marriage in Japan over on the right. And I'll just tell you a little something about that, kind of interesting. The artist first painted that full size with the bride in a kimono. And when the first Japanese member of the church saw that, he said, "Ever do, Japanese Christians want to be married as Christians in America in white. They do not want to be married in traditional gowns. That's Shinto or Buddhist or something, but it's not Christian." And so he had to go back and paint out this gorgeous kimono and paint in a Christian marriage or wedding dress. And then they were very happy with that. You have to look at it. In the middle, blessing of children from Latin America. Over on the left, administration to the sick in Haiti. Move on. Oh, you can hardly see that. What a shame. That's baptism in Africa. The models they used were real people. I met that lady in Africa, but she was in a desert. So he took a little... Pardon me? This lady happened to live in Lodwar, Kenya, up in the northern part. But you can hardly see her in this. I'm really sorry that it's kind of washed out. This one is... let me see here. This would be ordination in French Polynesia. This is evangelist blessing in North America, or patriarchal blessing if a male is doing it. This is the communion or the Lord's Supper in India, and confirmation in Australia. So those are the sacraments which the RLDS Church performs, and they're all shown in paintings there. Immediately outside of the chapel is the meditation garden that was built by gardeners from Independence's sister city in Japan, Higashi Muriyama. Now, I know that is a... Okay, do you want to go back and if there's any that you want to see the others, I'll... Huh? You want to go back and see the paintings? They were... I'd like to see that after. All right, we'll go back and look at those a little more closely. Okay, oh yeah, look at that. You can actually see them. You can actually get the colors. Okay, that's the African one. That's baptism. The man who's doing the baptism looks very much like one of our church ministers in Kenya by the name of Gamaliel Awor. I'd swear to goodness that was him, but the artist says it was he made it up, but I doubt it. It's Polynesia. The colors are really intense. These photographs just really don't give the full measure of the intensity of the color. It's really wonderful. In that one, yes. I've noticed. That would be ordination. Mm-hmm. That's part of the thing that's happened the last 10 years. You really don't notice these things anymore. It's so common. The fact that a woman would be doing it is you know, it's not an issue. What I've been told is a very representational view of what they would do in India in communion. We use little individual cups. Do you? Okay. Yeah, you use water. We still try to use grape juice. I'm not sure what they have. I've used Coke. Now, that would be a real bad thing. I had to do that on a camping trip when that was it, and we didn't even have good water. In Africa, believe it or not, you live on Coke. Either that or you you run the risk of getting whatever's in the water. Yeah, that's confirmation. Okay, here's our meditation garden. Some people have called it our Zen garden. There's nothing about, you know, it really isn't a Zen garden. It's just a beautiful meditation garden done on a Japanese theme, which expresses the intercultural basis of the temple. This is kind of the view that's out of President Smith's office. He's up on the second floor. This is taken from the first floor. But this is what he looks out on. If he looks up, he sees the spire of the temple. It's a wonderful view. The best view in the house, actually, which it ought to be. Those azalea bushes, by the way, have grown up quite a bit bigger since this picture was taken in the spring. That place is absolutely a riot of color. It's gorgeous. You just want to sit there. There are benches outside. You can go in there if you want, but it's also nicer to sit on the inside looking through the glass. It's quite beautiful. You can see it from four sides. There are corridors all the way around it. And there are people all the time just standing there or sitting there looking in and meditating over whatever. Okay, I think what we need at this point is another overhead. The impact of the temple on the Reorganized Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints has been enormous. On the most superficial yet important level, the temple project encouraged the church to focus on a positive project in the midst of an internal turmoil. The aftermath of ordination of women, which began in November 1985, included an increasingly bitter rear guard movement by the church's most ardent conservatives. While exact figures probably will never be known, most observers estimate that between 20 and 35% of the church's active membership left over the issue. The atmosphere during the mid to late 1980s was both tense and negative. The temple project allowed loyal members to concentrate on something besides the acrimonious divorce which was taking place. In the classic sociological sense, the temple helped those loyal to the church leaders to redirect their energies toward a common goal. On a more fundamental and lasting level, however, the temple has affected both the church's organization and theology in diverse ways. Headquarters operations have been shuffled into new categories reflecting the functions of the temple as identified in section 156. The contrast is most obvious when one looks at the organizational charts pre-temple and post-temple. The late 1980s structure is a classic and complex chain of command structure, which is what you're seeing up there. There'll be a test on that in about 5 minutes. The first level below the general officers of the church is the divisional level. So you can see up there the first presidency, the bishop, presiding bishopric, the Council of 12, and then down below there is the divisional level. Nearly all headquarters functions were subsumed under one of those divisions. Now, in 1992, let's see the next one of these. Well, this doesn't have all the ones down below the divisional level, but you can see what's happened here. The divisions are still there, but there's another level, which is called the, for lack of a better word, just the administrator level. The divisional functions below, they have collected the divisional functions below four administrators reporting to the first presidency. The number of new functions, or a number, rather, of new functions were instituted under the leadership of the Temple Ministries Administrator, Dr. Wayne A. Ham. Some of you know Wayne. Most of the functions in this category were completely new activities for the church. Now you can show us the little rosette. Oh, you want to pull it back to the other one? Yeah, the 12 apostles are out doing missionary work. And they are, the 12 apostles have responsibility for the work in the field. And this particular chart does not show the 12 apostles because this is just concentrating on the headquarters structure alone. But, you know, they're out working. And they are responsible for all of our church jurisdictions. Okay, now this particular design here, I'll start over here. Partly to represent a significant departure from the past, these new functions have been represented by a stylistic spiral rosette instead of the traditional organizational chart. They include the Temple Peace Center, which sponsors the annual Peace Colloquy and Temple Peace Prize, which, by the way, this past year was given to Dr. Jahan Sadat, Anwar Sadat's widow, for her work in working with children in Egypt and other places. It develops, the Temple Peace Center also develops and encourages children's peace programs and searches for ways to pursue peace activities in an ecumenical environment. The Temple Worship Center conducts all worship activities in the temple, encourages community participation. The Abundant Life Center sponsors elder hostels, health, wholeness, and reconciliation studies, and other retreats and seminars aimed at achieving a unity of body, mind, and spirit. The Temple Service Center coordinates a variety of volunteer services. This is an activity that I'm sure you would be very familiar. And it sponsors research and training activities. The Temple Missionary Center is an adjunct of the Quorum of 12 and the Quorums of 70 and supports their ministries and functions. The Temple School Center conducts educational activities ranging from accredited graduate education programs to a major investment in priesthood and leadership education, spiritual retreats, and other conferences. It also coordinates activities of the Church Library and Archives, the Historian's Office, and the Museum. So you can see that there are a lot of things going on there. The Temple Peace Center is brand new. Almost everything that's done in the Temple Peace Center, the church never did before. The Temple Worship Center, we did have a worship office before that, but a lot of what it does, it never did before. The Abundant Life Center is totally new. The church has never been involved in the activities that are identified there. The Temple Service Center, we never had anything that was that regular before. The Temple Missionary Center is something we've, of course, done in the past, but we've just put it under a different rubric there. More than anything else the temple may have done for the church, it has focused the church's energies toward the ministries of peacemaking. And we'll show another. These are the some of the historic and contemporary renditions of the church seal. Since the 1800s, the church's official seal has prominently displayed the word peace. For the first time in over a century, the church is trying to live up to its motto. Although the name has not completely caught on, many members refer to the Independence Temple as the Peace Temple or the Temple Ensign of Peace. During a session of the Mormon History Association's 1993 meeting in Lamoni, Iowa, which dealt with recent changes in RLDS theology and practice, an incredulous Mormon rose to ask a question of the president of the RLDS Quorum of 12 Apostles, Jeffrey F. Spencer, who, by the way, has recently retired. He was chairing the session. The man, obviously accustomed to a church whose message to him was clear, consistent, and faithful, wanted to know just what it was that the RLDS church was selling. Apostle Spencer's reply was, in effect, that the RLDS message was changing. In some ways, the church's recent emphasis on peace is becoming its message. Its major focus in place of the concept of Zion, which motivated its members throughout most of the 20th century. The goal of gathering to Zion in Missouri first became less compelling when President Israel A. Smith was in French Polynesia. To a query from Tahitians, and I didn't have one from his era, so I just showed one who was in the temple. To a query from Tahitians as to how and when they should gather to the center place, he replied that they were called to gather to certain islands of their archipelago, but not necessarily to the United States. Since then, the church has placed less and less emphasis on gathering as a principle and Zion as an overall goal. It's not that they don't believe it anymore. It's just that they're not concentrating on it in the same sense that they had before. Together with the increasing mainstream and Protestant-like nature of RLDS theology and practice, the historic sectarian qualities of the RLDS Church became less compelling to many of its members, especially those in nations outside of North America. The loss of its historic distinctives dismayed the Church's conservative wing. Discontent on the part of the Church's traditionalists had become evident for at least 20 years before the exodus of the 1980s in response to the ordination of women. The rapidity by which those who stayed have embraced the peace focus of the temple may well reflect a hunger for a clear sense of direction and meaning in the life of the church. The new RLDS church, temple, is more than simply a big church, as it is often called in Africa and Asia. By the way, in those continents, the term temple has Hindu and Muslim overtones and so forth, so they don't use that word. Its dual nature pervades all of the church's activities. It has become both a program and a resource, a means and an end in itself. It is both symbol and substance, goal, and a method of achieving it. At first glance, it may appear to be function following form, but that would deny the planning and expectations that preceded its construction. In fact, the temple is the focus of an exciting and dynamic adventure in the RLDS Church, which it is experiencing as it reexamines its heritage for links to its origins and looks to the future for new ways of relating to a world in need. I personally find it a heady and challenging period in which to live. Things have changed so fast in the past 20 years that few would be so bold as to predict that what the RLDS Church might look like in another decade, let alone a full generation. One thing is evident, however. The RLDS experience is growing in another direction from the LDS. The two churches with almost the same exact name have become vastly different over the decades. One reason for their relatively cordial relations of late is that their messages and practice are so vastly different that they no longer appeal to the same clientele. At long last, the RLDS can admire the LDS for their admirable successes in so many areas as the faithful life without feeling the pangs of jealousy. Well, maybe a twinge or two. For now, the RLDS have embarked on a journey distinctly their own. It may be symbolized by the giant stainless steel cross over the temple's entrance, graced by two olive branches arranged so that from a distance they appear to be the wings of a descending dove. In my youth, one rarely saw a cross on RLDS church buildings. Many RLDS used to make a distinction between being RLDS and being Christian. Today, the church is identifying with the larger Christian faith community to an extent never imagined a generation ago. The church is open to ecumenical participation in temple programs. A good example, there is Dr. Sadat and her bodyguard. We've had Native American services and elements in services. Here's an example of the peace colloquy in December of 1993. Those of you who might recognize Martin Marty on the right, who spoke to a Mormon History Association meeting in Omaha, Nebraska a number of years ago. Next to him is Rabbi Michael Zedek, a Reform Jewish rabbi from the Kansas City area. Next to him is Dr. Rifat Hassan, an Islamic scholar. And next to him is a member of our church, former president of Graceland College. And you'll notice the symbols. This is in the temple, the symbols of the great religions of the world. It was a seminar on what we call Windows of Peace, trying to create, we were looking for the elements of peace in the various world religions, dialogues. The church is currently investigating the possibilities of a number of ecumenical links and a variety of other activities. It would be difficult at this point to reverse this trend and return to the church's standoffish sectarian stance of 50 years ago. The new Independence Temple has been instrumental in altering the direction the church is taking. It would be fascinating to be around 50 years from now to see how it all turns out. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Are there any more questions?
Okay.
We had a question over here and then a question.
Okay.
I will.
I had a couple questions. One of them was, as the church continues its ecumenical mission, I wondered what will happen to members of the John Whitmer Historical Association. And will there be a group of RLDS scholars who continue to pursue that kind of historical?
Well, as the editor of the JWHA Journal, I certainly hope there will be. The question is, will the John Whitmer Historical Association continue? I think so. One interesting commonality among at least the LDS and RLDS, I don't know about the other restoration groups, is that we do have a tremendous focus on the past. In some respects, it might almost be a little unhealthy. I happen to be... I didn't say that. Focusing on the past is never unhealthy. I just betrayed my historical heritage. But I did read an interesting quote from Paul Edwards that I just want to share with you just a word or two here, if I can quickly find it here in the book. He says, he was talking about the RLDS church in which he grew up. Paul Edwards is director of the Temple School Center. He's also the acting church historian at the present time. He's a former president of the Mormon History Association. Many of you know Dr. Edwards. How many of you know Paul Edwards? Some of you do. He mentioned in his book, Poetics of Place, the movement, meaning the RLDS Church, had a preoccupation, if in fact not an obsession, with the past. It was more than a love affair with its beginnings, a motivation for looking back. Although it had many of the characteristics one associates with unrequited love, this attachment to past was more than the necessity of explanation. It also served the members as a substitute for worship and for theology. In this tradition, the movement was often guilty of substituting the myths of uncovering for the parables of discovery. That's an interesting thought. We're trying to work our way around those kinds of problems. Did you have another question? Okay, did you have a...
I'm curious, what's happened to those 25-30% Orthodox RLDS? What have they done?
Orthodox? Can we call them traditional? or they call themselves fundamentalists in most cases. Well, actually, some have. There are, in fact, a few churches that have given up the possibility of purging the RLDS Church of its apostasy and have organized themselves. But the majority of them have stayed almost in a Baptist-like congregational approach where they get together for common meetings, but they stay as separate what they call restoration branches, some of them very small, some of them quite large. And by that I mean, you know, hundreds and hundreds of members. I know one of them that's probably over 1,000. And that's in Independence. There are a lot of them in Independence. I would guess maybe 12,000 in the Kansas City area worship in these independent restoration branches. One of the reasons that they have resisted joining together is that a fellow by the name of Richard Price, who has been a persistent critic of the church leadership for the last 25 years, really does believe deep in his heart of hearts that God is going to somehow smite the leadership of the church and the hierarchy, as he calls it. They will melt away and the restoration branches will then inherit the church and its properties and will get it back to where it should have been. And as long as he still has influence, I don't think they're ever going to join together. I mean, he actively opposes it. I compare very, very much the Restoration Branch movement today to where the RLDS Church was in the 1850s, when it was really trying to figure out just exactly what it was going to do, and it still thought it was the true church, and the people that had gone out here were wrong, and so forth. It's the parallels are striking, spooky even. All the way against the wall there.
So what was the
population the RLDS Church claims a membership, a book membership of about 250,000. of that, probably half are reasonably active. And the third that we were talking about would be probably the third that came out of that active group. So, and most of those people have not withdrawn their names from the church. So it's a little hard to say exactly, you know, who is and who isn't. But I would guess that we probably have somewhere in the vicinity of 100,000 active RLDS. You had a comment. What role does the Book of Mormon play? Decreasing. I'm sorry to say. I've preached from it on numerous occasions. People will quote from it. It's rare that you have a sermon based entirely upon Book of Mormon text. General officers will still quote from it. It's still officially part of our heritage. We still have courses that priesthood can take in it. We have Sunday school helps. But in terms, if you were going to say, you know, what's our emphasis, a relative emphasis on a scale of 1 to 10, you know, the Bible is probably an 8. The Doctrine and Covenants would be 1.5, and the Book of Mormon would be 0.5. In that combination, it's still there, but they don't concentrate it on it. Would you agree with that?
Yes. Someone asked this morning if the Book of Mormon, how we believe about it, is it true or not true, makes a difference in our eligibility or our membership?
Yeah, the question is, does how you believe about the Book of Mormon make any difference to your eligibility and membership? We have a number of people in our church who flat deny the Book of Mormon's historicity, and they continue to function. I don't know how they do that, frankly. I couldn't do that. I mean, to me, the Book of Mormon is very important, because if you don't, I mean, you may have some debate about exactly how the translations took place and so forth, but if you deny that, you deny the credibility of Joseph Smith, and that blows the credibility of the entire movement. If you deny the Book of Mormon, you're going to have to come up with some other raison d'être, I think. It's not a test of fellowship. It is not a test of fellowship. That is correct. Comment.
I was wondering whether the traditionalists still call themselves members of your fellowship.
Well, they do in their own branches. They're not allowed to advertise themselves that way because we've copyrighted the name. And we don't want people to be confused. But they still do. I have a cousin, actually a niece, who was recently baptized into one of them, and I asked him how she was baptized, asked her, and she said, just like anyone else, and meaning that they used the same terminology. And so they're continuing. They believe they're part of the true RLDS church. This will go on for some time, I'm sure.
I just thought of another comment I had that relates to the number of people who left the church. My conversations with Mark and Dick Troll at MHA, they both commented that their membership in the church now is a result of the revelation or allowing them into the priesthood, and that if that hadn't come, they and a number of other members of the church would probably have not continued their association with the church. So their emphasis was one that people don't usually point out, that the church kept a number of its members by opening the priesthood to women, and that they felt the core church is stronger as a result, even though a large number of people.
Okay, the comment was regarding some people by the name of Tro who said that they're in the church because of this. Actually, you happen to mention our two very closest friends. Marge Tro used to be our women's ministry consultant, which would be comparable to the head of the Women's Relief Society. And to make a long story short, she was forced to resign over some policy differences with the first presidency. And they went through a real valley of the shadow over that. And the opening of the priesthood to women, by the way, Marge is serving as a high priest at the present time. She was ordained a high priest same time I was ordained to the office of bishop. But this has saved them to the church. And it is true that we have had a number of people who have come either back to the church, who have become inactive, or have joined the church because of this. But I doubt that that is going to be a big issue in the future because, as I say, it's no longer, women in the priesthood is no longer kind of a new thing. It's just there. And people take it as a matter of fact. What's really interesting is the different perspectives that we have on what our purpose is. And that has to do mostly with the peace emphasis. And that's becoming a major thing. As far as the attitude of the church is concerned, I have never in all my life seen the RLDS church more positive than it is now. The attitude is very, very positive. I'm sorry, did I... Do you want to come up here and use the mic? Mary Jo, in case you don't know, Mary Jo Rhodes is a former district president of the Mojave District south of here.
Yes, I'm an elder in an RLDS church. When my husband and I came out to Nevada, Las Vegas, I was at that time the only priesthood member of the church, and there had been some difficulties in that branch. Anyway, but the separation had kind of already taken place, but there were women who had been called and not yet finished their preparation for ordination. Now we have a number who serve very diligently, including the co-pastors are both young women. There are members of the church that come every Sunday and are very diligent who still cannot accept women in the priesthood. We love each other dearly. I know this is on tape. I better know. But they still may not take. The person in charge is sensitive to the fact that they would not take communion from a woman and puts a man to serve the communion there. But they are diligent. They're staying. Sometimes I wonder if we'd had a restoration congregation in Las Vegas if they would not attend there. But their devotion to the church is so great that they're staying, and they're changing little by little, I think. Now and then we'll get someone come down, snowbirds come down for the winter, that we hear the same old, you know, about God never intended this, you know, and it's kind of disruptive. But we have a lot of unity now, in effect, even if not in fact.
Okay, I saw a comment back here. Yes. Figuratively speaking. Well, I think that's a wonderful theory about the RLDS taking the female and the LDS taking the male. I'm not sure that would be historically supported. particularly if you go back 25 years in our own church, which, do I dare say this on tape? I think I will. You know, our church, for quite a few years, up until recently, has always had, well, in fact, we still have a Smith, a direct descendant of Joseph Smith as president of the church. And the current prophet, Wallace B. Smith, has indicated that that isn't necessarily going to continue. So that, apparently, at this point, is now a dead issue. But it was still a very live issue back in the 1940s when the daughter of the prophet of the church, F.M. Smith, after he died, the presidency of the church went not to his daughter, who was his heir, but to her uncle, his brother. And she commented, she was married to F. Henry Edwards, who later became a counselor to the president of the church, and eventually first counselor to the first president. But Alice Edwards, a Smith, said, if I'd had a penis, I'd have been a prophet. We were very masculine-oriented until very recently. I wouldn't say that the church is particularly femininely oriented today. I would have to say that there certainly has been a major emphasis on attempting to androgenize many of the elements of the church, and by that I mean to make it inclusive. That has been a very deliberate effort, and we work very hard to avoid gender-related language relating to divinity. You will never in our church publications refer to God being referred to as our Heavenly Father, although you know, many people still do that in prayers. I make a very, very concerted effort to avoid that even in my public ministry. It is a very strong effort to androgenize the ministry. Thank you for commenting on that. How do I address deity? God, Almighty God. There are all kinds of names for God that are not gender exclusive. Yet another significant difference between the LDS and RLDS is how much difference there is between the two churches in how they regard the scriptures literally. The RLDS are far less inclined to take the scriptures literally than the LDS, and consequently that would not be a problem for us. Do they? Yeah. The question is, where do the restoration groups meet? Some of them meet in some of the churches we used to own. We sold a few of our churches to them. To be honest, when they left, in some cases, entire congregations left, leaving just a shell behind that wasn't capable of continuing to maintain a separate church. And so in some cases, we just sold the church to them at a bargain price. I mean, they paid for it in the first place. So we sold it back to them. In other cases, they built their own. So it's you know, it's a mixed bag.
This is like, as you said earlier, this is like the Baptist concept of congregational autonomy. Do these churches, being autonomous, do they contribute to the centralized focus of the church by sending people to general offices?
I guess I don't understand the question. Do they send delegates? We have had to develop, the question is, do they play a part in the political life of the church? The answer is mostly not. That issue came up before our World Conference. I think it was two conferences ago. We meet every 2 years. And they had to decide just exactly, you know, these people haven't taken their name off the book, but they're meeting in a different group. And so what we have done is to create a category of membership called not affiliated, which means that they are still on the books and they are still eligible to take the sacrament and they're still eligible to receive various ordinances of the church, but they are not eligible to vote because they do not belong to one of our church jurisdictions. They're kind of like a person without a country, in a sense. You know, they're... it's okay, but okay. We had one more question. Is that all? Well, two more questions. We had. I don't know. We'll see what happens.
The square footage,
is it a round footage? I think we can move on to another question. I love that. I have no idea. Lots. What about the word of wisdom? Do I understand the question to be, do we believe it? Do we follow it? Some do. It's not consistent. Yeah, coffee is widely regarded as not being covered by the word of wisdom. And the Smith family themselves, shall I tell them the story? I have to tell you a story about President Smith and coffee. The Smiths have always liked coffee. I don't know. It must have started with Joseph III, but maybe Joseph Jr. Who knows? But I was taking a break one time from work when the Joint Council took a break from their deliberations, and they all came into the snack room. And there were a couple of coffee urns. One was up on a table and one was down on the floor. And the one that was on the floor was because all the outlets were on use up at the top and they didn't have room for it. So they all lined up and they were going through pouring their cups of coffee. When President Wallace Smith got to it, it ran out. And so he took his cup and he knelt down on the floor to pour it out. He didn't want to lift the urn up onto the counter, and so he just knelt down there and started pouring his cup of coffee. I happened to be sitting next to the president of the Council of 12, Apostle Cole, and we both looked down and saw Wally, as we call him, pouring a cup of coffee for himself, and we started to laugh. It was funny. And President Smith looked up and said, "What's so funny?" And Apostle Cole said, "Oh, watching the prophet of the church kneeling down before a coffee urn." And One of President Smith's delightful qualities is that he blushes. And he blushed bright red. And he said, "You think this is something?" He said, "You ought to see me at 6:30 in the morning." He says, "I'm prostrate in front of one." One other comment. What is the significance of the RLDS Church of... What is the significance of Joseph Smith Jr. to the RLDS Church in light of its ecumenical directions? Okay. He's the founder of our church. Well, what makes the RLDS church different from any other church? Vis-a-vis Joseph Smith. He founded our church. He didn't found theirs. I guess I'm not following your direction you're going. Well, of course, half of our Doctrine and Covenants has his revelatory documents which guide us. Joseph Smith Jr. is greatly revered in our church. I would have to say, in all candor, that our RLDS in general ignore the developments that took place in Nauvoo. They know, many of them know about them. Nevertheless, they choose to ignore them. They certainly do not pick up on the developments that occurred post-Nauvoo. The whole concept of temple ritual, and I just came out of a session which attempted to link Masonry and Kabbalah and Hermeticism and a lot of other occult practices with Joseph. I don't know how the LDS feel about it, but if Joseph was in fact involved with any of those things, we ignore them. I wouldn't say that any RLDS would go so far as to say that Joseph was in apostasy, although some have. I've heard that. I don't know of any leaders that would go so far as to say that. But I would have to say that just like baptism for the dead, if you don't pay any attention to it over a period of time and you don't practice it, you forget about it. And so the question, I suppose, comes up to, well, is it really